Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast. We do movie discussions where we roll die to decide the genre of the movie that we're going to discuss. And we also do interviews. I hope everybody's having a good day. And today we're going to be doing a movie discussion on documentaries and Orson Welles. I'm going to be joined with Joshua Kennedy in a minute. We're going to be continuing our Orson Welles retrospective series. The first one we did, of course, was Touch of Evil, which you can go back and listen to. And I hope everybody will enjoy that one and enjoy this one also. Just before we get into the episode, I'm going to play one of the trailers for it. This one is not the original trailer. That one is 9 minutes long, and you can find it on YouTube. But this is the one that was put out by Criterion. It's 2.5 minutes. It'll give you an idea what to expect. And then after that, we're going to go straight into the movie discussion with Joshua Kennedy and myself. I hope everybody enjoys it.
Ladies and gentlemen, by way of introduction, this is a film about trickery and fraud, about lies.
You don't talk about Napoleon or Julius Caesar. You're talking about Elmire.
Elmire?
Elmire?
Who is Elmire? That question has yet to be answered with any real precision.
Can I kiss you too?
Anybody wants to eat?
In the world of the jet setters among us beautiful people, everybody knows Elmire. But Elmire what?
He has about 60 times the same name.
De Hori?
He's called his name Ori, Uri, Bori, Suri, Cori, Bari, Dori, all the...
Papa.
With U-R-Y, 60 names.
His real name was Elmire Ferenc Huffman.
Then 60 personalities, as much lies and as much real.
Well, sounds very Jesuitic.
Yes, his world is a world of make-believe.
I'm not an actor.
Not an actor? Elmire.
I'm not an actor. I am not a professional actor.
He's a leading actor in this movie. His profession, it's true, is painting fakes. Among all fakers, Elmire is number two.
Once I saw a man from Ibiza writing a book on fake who came to see me to Paris. He said, I heard you are the first man who bought an Elmire.
And that man's name was?
Clifford Irving.
The important distinction to make when you're talking about the genuine quality of a painting is not so much whether it's a real painting or a fake. It's whether it's a good fake or a bad fake.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Diecast Movie Podcast. And today we're going to be doing a movie discussion, continuing our saga of Orson Welles. Listeners that might remember from our past, we've done The Touch of Evil, which started our Charlton Heston and Orson Welles retrospective. And I think we started it off with a bang. And the Charlton Heston one continued on with The Omega Man, where we were joined by Mark Maddox. But now Joshua Kennedy and I are going to be continuing on to Orson Welles with F for Fake. And of course, I already said his name. I'm being joined by Joshua Kennedy, director, actor, writer, international man of mystery. How you doing today, Josh?
I am doing very well, my good man. Thank you for having me back. Always a pleasure to talk cinema and movies and cinema and movies. How are you? You're the one that we should be asking about your health. Everything good?
I'm doing well. And as listeners know, some of the episodes, my children, or particularly Michaela, have been doing the introduction and saying, you know, I was out for health reasons. Bypass surgery, which was planned, you know, it wasn't because I had to go in for an emergency, to help set me up for a liver transplant, which will hopefully be happening later this year in the fall. We'll see, you know, how things go. But so, yeah, I'm doing well. I had lost my voice for like a month and a half, which the family really enjoyed because I was pretty much talking like this. But, you know, but I'm back in the saddle again, you know, recording, having fun, and just enjoying awesome. Myself. And that's the key.
Excellent.
Thing. How have you been?
I'm great. I'm delighted to hear you are much better. Was sending you positive energy and prayers, and I'm delighted to have you back in the saddle. So I'm very good. Finishing up, I think it's been last time we talked, I was still finishing Mantipus. That's the big joke right now. It's year 4 of Mantipus, but it is so good, and it's going to be well worth the wait. Well, we'll check back in another 4 years, and maybe I'll have it finished by then.
It's starting to sound like that Star Trek mission thing, the 5-year mission.
Yeah, right? Exactly, yes.
But of all good things, it's like a bottle of wine. It's just, you cannot serve it until it's time.
Exactly. And I think that's a perfect segue. The bottle of wine, isn't that, what's the wine commercial that Orson was in that he's like famously...
Drunk?
Drunk. He's like, the French, Pierre. I can't remember what the name of it is. But Orson Welles, we're back with Orson.
For yes. F for fake.
F for fake. Yeah. How did you? I mean, here I am. Now I'm all getting all nerded out. How did you? You're the host. You take over.
How did I discover it? Because as you know, Josh and I bounce back and forth about which movie we're gonna do, and so I picked F for fake, and I discovered it several years ago streaming on was HBO. Now it's Max. Kind of thing. So, and it's still on Max for those that are wondering, or you can get the Criterion version also, because that's out there. And I don't own this on physical media yet, but that'll eventually rectify itself, you know, sooner before later. And I saw it and I was just mesmerized by, as we'll get into more detail, the editing, the structure, how it was interweaving in and out, the trick within trick within trick, within tricks of going on, and the message about for the next 60 minutes, everything, or next hour, everything I say will be 100% true. And then of course, as they leave that, you know, cause you're in a movie feed, you're not paying attention to your watch and other stuff. And then eventually you end up mesmerized with this beautiful story, and only to find out that it's all been an illusion because the time had already passed 17 minutes or 27 minutes ago, and I've been lying my buttocks off to you the rest of this time. But it's when rewatching it, you can see exactly when that spot happens. I mean, it's pretty much, you don't have to have a clock on. I was looking at my watch to check at my stopwatch going, so when I knew the little alarm, so when 60 minutes had gone by, I heard it ding, so I knew. But when you're watching it, you can see when exactly the lies begin. And I just enjoyed it so much because it was so different in its style, being a documentary done in such a way where it was the documentary, but not a documentary. But so I gave my first thoughts about it. What was your first time seeing it and your first impressions?
I was so lucky enough to, when I was in New York City for school, that they showed Touch of Evil. It was at Film Forum. It's this little theater in Manhattan. They showed Touch of Evil and they showed F for Fake, and it was like a back to back. I didn't watch them back to back, but I want to say within the first 2 weeks, I saw Touch of Evil first, obsessed, and then went back and saw F for Fake. It was a little theater, but it was still a theater. And you're absolutely right. The just magic within it, the storytelling, just I always joke that they say who would be your favorite person to, you know, have lunch with, or any person in history who would you like to like have dinner with, and one of my go-tos is I just want to talk with Orson Welles, and just he just seems like a wonderful guy to talk with. What is such a rich, colorful past and Renaissance man. And there's another saying that he never, all of the times he talked about himself, he would constantly add to his, like he would never tell the truth in his own life. And I was like, that just seems like someone fun to have lunch spaghetti with. And this movie, my point being, this movie seems like an evening with Orson Welles. It's just him talking about, and he goes on rants and rambles, and it's called a documentary film, but it's, and I was reading up a few things on the internet before this, a documentary film, but more like a video essay. I think that's more of a personal essay on so many things, art and life, and there's so many different things, but that's what how I see it. It was like, oh, every time when you said, let's watch F for Fake, I thought to myself, oh, this is going to be fun because it's going to be an evening with Orson Welles. It's just always fun to sit and listen to him talk. How do we even describe it? For people who haven't seen it, how do we even, can it be described? You kind of have to see it to really get the full thing.
Well, since I picked it, I'll give it a go. I'll save
okay,
you.
Go ahead.
I'll save you. I'll save you the mental gymnastics, but
I mean, it's very simple, but it's. I don't know. Go ahead. You give it a try.
I'll give it a try, and you can add on to it if necessary, which it probably will be. But pretty much, this is F for Fake is about forgery, fraud, trickery in many different forms, but in particular, its focus is in art. And again, art is in many different forms, and they're going to be doing a lot of things about painting, but there's also a autobiography that is faked. There's also things that the War of the Worlds, where Orson Welles faked out the whole country, you know, with his radio drama famously, and all these other things. Howard Hughes, was he real or not real? So there's all these interwoven stories of fakeness or fakery. And that's the beauty of it all, how it got intertwined together with a framing story that starts off in the beginning, goes to the end, which is fake. And it also starts off, I think, wonderfully with a magic trick. And what is film? But as they say, the magic of filmmaking and how you have this trickery going on. And he's showing you some of these things with different, as how certain scenes segue into others, with the illusion being blown for you and showing you some of the stuff behind the scenes, but yet you're only seeing what the illusionist wants you to see, which means you're seeing virtually nothing at all. And that's what I love about it, because the mind that's working in setting this film up and how the hand of illusion is going is perfect. And I think this is what you're seeing. You are seeing literally, as you put it so eloquently, having dinner with Orson. You were basically having a performance done by Orson Welles on a stage, and he is just showing you things you want to believe, but the whole time he is leading you down this magical path. And I find it fascinating, because a lot of the film that he's using, he didn't even shoot. Because he was supposed to finish off this documentary about the art forger and finish the film, and how it just got ported into this other project and remade into something, I think, which is great.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well said. You summed it up. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Good night. that's for fake. Yeah, the thing that fascinates me from an editing standpoint, I mean, this whole film is such a wonderful masterclass in editing. Just how it started, right, as a documentary about an art forger. And then the writer who was writing the story about the art forger turned out to be a faker himself. Like, so Orson kept having to zoom out around his story. And it's like, okay, now it's a story that's, we're telling a story about the art forger. Okay, now we got to tell a story about the biographer of the art forger, who is also a faker. And it's like, well, then we zoom out, and the director of this film is me, but I'm also a faker. It's like a maze. It's like the Shining maze, the Theseus maze, where it's like, oh, now we're talking about this, and it all interconnects. It's wonderful. And how he cuts it together with editing. It's any filmmaker listening to this really should check it out. I'm sure film students are so tired of, oh, how many times are we going to hear about Orson Welles? No, watch this film, and then maybe you'll understand. Oh, it's wonderful, and it's constantly moving and changing. There's never a dull moment. I'm never bored watching this movie, which is fascinating for a documentary about art forgery. It's so fresh. It seems like it was made today. It's so ahead of its time.
Exactly. And the editing, people have to remember, this is back when you're using film. So, yeah. Which I know, Josh, you've done with some of your movies. You've done some where you're like, we're using real film. And then there's other times you're using digital. And the edit things with digital that are digitally filmed is so much easier to do. I remember back when I was in school, we used to have to, this is not film school, but this was like back in like high school and in middle school. I used to be like help out in the library where we had films and that kind of stuff. And every so often something would break and we had to put them together, you know, splice them back together. I can't do that now, but I could do it back then. And it was just, it's a tedious task to do. But yet for filmmaking back then, you had to do it. And I love that they show scenes with him in the editing room doing that. The magic is happening right there.
And he's narrating to the camera. It's like, okay, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to show you a scene from this. Then you're going to find out that the first 5 seconds are fake or whatever he says. And it's, you're right. And I can't imagine editing this amount of footage with actual film. That must have been a nightmare. And he's doing freeze frames and he's doing zoom ins and he's cutting from this to that. And like, this is, I would have been, I mean, we're not Orson Welles. It's like, just thinking, he's almost thinking digital editing in an old film, because he's doing stuff that you would, it's so easy to do on your phone or on iMovie or something, and cutting here and cutting back. And it's like, no, this was actual film. He is so ahead of its time. It's fascinating to watch. Fascinating.
Yeah, basically, like you just said, a digital mind in an analog world. I mean, and how.
Yeah, there you go. Yes. Yeah.
If he would have been around with the technology and the stuff that's available now, it would be astronomical what he would be able to pull off and do, especially with the computer effects.
Oh man. Yes.
He would be totally genius. And one thing I do want to talk about, you said how you saw Touch of Evil, then this. We did not know that when we started off this Orson Welles thing. I did not know about Josh's, like, how he saw him when he was in college. This was sheer serendipity.
Hey, right, exactly, yes. Oh, man, those were a good few months there. There was something else that I watched they showed there. It might have been Macbeth, one of his lesser-known stuff. And it was just like, whoa, what a slap in the face, a great slap in the face of just like, hey, this can be done. This can be things. Again, what you said it perfectly. The digital mind in an analog world. He's doing stuff. This almost, F for Fake seems like a YouTube video essay. You watch, you know, people will spend hours talking about The Matrix or, you know, Star Wars or why the Force Awakens is a terrible film. And Orson is doing stuff in F for Fake that seems like a YouTube channel. Like he's putting in his own opinions. I can't turn off. If you haven't seen this film, turn to this, this podcast off and watch it and then come back. I don't think we're going to be able to do it justice. There's so much in it.
Well, one thing I want to say, go with your YouTube analogy.
Yeah.
I watched for the first time in preparing for this, the 9-minute trailer that he made,
yes.
Which is its own little mini movie, yes. So to speak, which would be like a YouTube video, which is to get people to see the movie with footage and stuff done that you're and things they say you're going to see in the movie that you're never going to see. So the F for Fake trailer is itself a fraud about what you're going to see, which we all know movies have been doing since the beginning. Trailers, people say, well, that wasn't in the trailer. The Hulk was there. Now they got him in the Hulk. You know, it's really the Bruce Banner and the Hulkbuster thing. They lied to us, you know, just using a more recent analogy. Or just the poster had Robbie the Robot carrying Anne Francis. But no, he's carrying the guy. It's not, that's a lie. Yes, they lied to you to get your butt in the seat. And this trailer itself has truths in it that are in the movie and lies in it. I mean, I love it. It's just, it's so meta.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. Very meta. And I'm sure, I mean, I'm reading up just very vaguely before we talked about how people hated it. Critics hated it when it first came out. I can somewhat understand that they're just used to it. A classic documentary. This is how grass grows. This is how paint dries. This is, you know, where cheese is made. And then Orson comes in with this frenetic, cacophonous cornucopia of images. And you're just like, wait, what the hell is going on? And people couldn't take it. It was just way too avant-garde. And it's just fascinating that we watch it now. And it's like, oh, I know exactly what I can follow this perfectly. It's very interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely got its critical approval later in its life than its initial run. And it's one of those films, I know you said there's other films that are lesser known. I think a lot of our listeners, when they see the title F for Fake or Orson Welles, those that know Orson Welles' work, they're gonna know. It's a given.
Of course.
But the average film enthusiast probably has never seen this film. I've talked to some guys I know that, you know, they love films, and I'll say, oh, yeah, we're going to be doing F for Fake. They're like, well, Orson Welles did that. What's it about? They don't even know what it's about and that kind of thing. I said, I don't even tell my own. I'm always being the promoter, I always say, well, you know, when you listen to the episode, you'll find out.
Hey, that's good showmanship.
They'll say, what are your thoughts on it? It's like, you'll find out.
You'll find out, yeah.
You always got to be the tease or give them just enough to want them to come in. And then, of course, did I tell them the truth, what I said, or did I make it up?
Oh,
we all are doing that. I mean, it's the beauty of it. Because, I mean, you could have pulled this back to another level where the audience members that are some there, are some of them real or some of them frauds themselves? I mean, this is so way to look at it.
Yeah.
It's where our society is or societies have been since the beginning. Do we really ever show our true selves to anybody?
Yeah. I was very taken with, I mean, and there's so many, I don't even know where to even take, because there's so many moving pieces in the film.
Well, go with the moving piece that's with the opening credits, because that is kind of eye-catching.
With the opening, well.
And that's the whole point of it, because that's what they bring out with it. And it was his muse at the time.
Yes. What's her name? Ula. I always want to call her Ula. Ula. Olaf.
Oya Kodo?
Oya.
Whatever. I feel like we're about to go into Kool-Aid Man.
Yeah. So his muse, his romantic interest, Orson Welles's actress, model, woman. She comes in and out throughout the story. And it starts off with her. She's a beautiful Hungarian?
Croatian?
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's where she's from. But they label her as Hungarian in the movie.
Hungarian, yes. Well, of course, everything's fake, so they can, she's Hungarian, yeah, if you want her to be. And she's just walking down the street. The camera loves her, and you can tell, I mean, Orson behind the camera in the editing room, he loves her. And she's a beautiful woman walking down the street, and we're watching just different men on the street just watching a beautiful woman pass by. And it's a wonderful montage on, they don't realize they're being filmed, and it's almost like human nature. It's lovely to watch. It's so innocent, and they're just like checking her out and like maybe like, hey, look at this beautiful woman. And it's what a great way to start the movie, because it's just like, okay, we're watching a beautiful woman, yes, but we're also watching the men watching her. So we're watching the watchers. There's so many levels.
And at something that just hit me now, but a lot of those guys' reactions We don't even know what they were turning their head to look at or what they were staring at. Was it her?
Hey, yeah.
Or was it something totally different? We're in the context of the movie, we are led to believe, but that is what the illusionist wants us to think. And I know there's a scene later on we'll talk about where they make something look like it's happening, but the two guys were never filmed together at the time. It was a total illusion.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. I mean, we're kind of like keen to some of these tricks because we're film buffs, and it's like we know, okay, they're not in the same scene, or perhaps a shot of a man raising his eyebrows, he might be doing that because, you know, someone slipped on the sidewalk, but you cut it next to the beautiful woman and he looks like he's, you know, maybe has nefarious thoughts. But then this whole movie is like that. It's like the more you analyze it, the more it starts to fall apart. It's like, well, is that really a footage of this or that? Is that really? And it's
I want to answer. I don't think when you realize it that the movie's falling apart. I think to me it adds to the movie.
In my sense,
I don't think of ever when you start to realize some of these little tricks, which are a multitude, and I don't think I'll ever be able to figure out all of them.
But
I think to me it adds to the whole experience, so you can enjoy this in multiple viewings.
Well, yes, I absolutely, and you'll see something new every time I watch it. I see something new. I meant, let me rephrase, more like what you thought was going to be clean and like maybe straight lines, and you're like, I got it. The more you analyze it, that starts to fall apart. It's like, oh wait, there's more behind this. I didn't mean that the movie doesn't fall apart. It just becomes more dense and complex, and let me rephrase that, but. Yes, one of my favorite, I mean, the first, they have that montage, and then it's Orson Welles in wonderful costume. He's just like a magician costume. What would we call that? Just Orson Welles, black hat and cape. Like, that's just his cloak is just a wonderful outfit for him. Yeah. And he's on the train station, and he goes, here, come closer. And he's at a train station. We know that he introduces the cameraman and the sound man, and then they put a white sheet behind him, and it zooms in, and he's talking to you for a bit. He's like, okay, this is what the movie's going to be. And then they move the sheet, and he's in the studio. It's like, whoa, okay, this is – and that's my favorite shot. It zooms out, and then the studio lights start coming on, and you realize, okay, this is going to be a spectacle. This is going to be a show. This is going to be a magic trick. And the movie is just filled with little moments like that are – He pauses, like you said, meta. He pauses the film. You're watching it, everything's fine, and then he'll pause it and interject with narration. He goes, this is before we realize that the guy who's speaking turned out to be a total fake, and then he'll play the movie. It's just so modern and fresh. And again, I can only imagine what the critics were thinking when they first saw it. They must have been nauseated with the fourth wall breaking and the freeze frames and the rewinding. Good stuff.
Orson Welles was doing the Deadpool before Deadpool was ever known, you know, with the character.
Interjecting.
And because even sometimes they're shooting footage and he'll just turn and be looking right at the camera and just saying stuff. And other times he's totally oblivious to the camera as it's like you would do in most films. And the story, as we said earlier, it follows art fraud, autobiography fraud, possibly a person impersonating another person type fraud, which we don't know for sure. That one's never rectified because nobody knows. And the characters that are involved with this, you know, of course, the person that we're not sure of, is it really him or whatever, is Howard Hughes, you know, which is over all going through the whole movie. Clifford Irving wrote a book that claimed it was the autobiography of Howard Hughes. And that's how Howard Hughes gets involved in the movie, because of the Clifford Irving book. But Clifford Irving is also writing the book and doing these things in the documentary that was being filmed initially on Almir de Hora, the artist who does forgeries, you know, and basically passes them off. And of course, we already talked about how Orson Welles himself perpetuates fraud with doing movies, and of course you go back to the War of the Worlds, which I find interesting. According to what I read, that the audio they used for War of the Worlds was not the true audio from War of the Worlds.
I thought of that watching it last night. I'm like, that's not even, because I listen to that every. I try and listen to it every Halloween, and just when I'm going to sleep, because it's just a tradition I have. And watching the movie, I'm like, that's not even the actual audio that they whether they. I'm like, it's Orson Welles. Like, could he not get the rights, or he purposefully didn't put it in? You know, just to add more forgery. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. There was something else that he's using footage from Earth versus the Flying Saucers throughout. And I'm like, that's not even from War of the World. Like, it's just. Sorry, go on, continue, please.
Oh no, that's where I was heading to. It's just, I love it because it's so. It's like, okay, I'm not even going to use my own stuff.
Yeah,
I'm gonna do that as a fraud, and it's just so wonderfully done, and how it just spirals out from these stories, and how they interrelate, but yet don't interrelate, but yet they do interrelate, mm-hmm. because like Orson's story really doesn't, you know, it doesn't really intertwine with the other two as well, but it has that encompassing thing, and then of course Olya and her. Story with Picasso and her
yes.
grandfather, who's a forger, and how that's all played out and done, and so wonderfully acted at the end, and has this footage that's going on. But is that true or is that fake? And Orson Welles' story capabilities, his voice, his ability to lead anything. I mean, he's got one of those voices that you just want to hear them do everything. And, you know, like there's Morgan Freeman, there's Orson Welles, there's several voices that you can just,
yeah,
they are the voice. And there were so many things that he did that I grew up with in the 70s and 80s where he was the narrator and those kind of things. And it's just because he had that ability to make lines of dialogue just sing.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's why one of the funniest things Mel Brooks ever did was hire him to be the narrator in History of the World Part 1. Just the fact that he's there, it just brings such joy to my heart. You know, Torquemada, the Grand Inquisitor, the Great Inquisition. I mean, it's just, yeah. And you're right. Like I said, this movie is sitting down to dinner with him and just letting him tell his stories. It's like, you tell your stories, Orson, even if they're complete fakery. The whole thing about him being in Ireland as a painter, I was like, okay, is that true? Is that, and how would we know if he's making that up? That he, as a 16-year-old, he was in Ireland and made his living by painting for farmers, and then had a little cart. And I don't know. It's just the way the film is structured. You're like, okay, am I even supposed to buy that story? Am I, you know what I mean?
The only reason you would buy it is if you follow that he was honest. Which, for somebody who's admitted fraudster, you have to believe them. This is almost like the Harry Mudd in that one Star Trek episode. Well, everything I'm telling you is a lie. But if everything you tell me is a lie, then what you're telling me, you know, it's like, is the truth.
Exactly.
And that kind of thing. But he said for the next 60 minutes, the next hour, everything I tell you is true. And that was during that 60-minute part.
That's fair.
But then you have to admittedly believe that a liar is telling you the truth.
Yes.
When you're dealing with a story about people that perpetuate fraud and all the levels, is anybody really telling you the truth at any point? Mm-hmm. Because you have to believe what a fraudster is telling you is true. So is anything really true? Or is it, as we all, when I interview people, and I'll interview people, like several people that are involved in the same project, and you get different versions of that project.
Oh, yeah.
And people say, well, this person was telling the truth. I go with the theory now. They're all telling me the truth. They're telling me their truth about what happened during that project. And yes, there's going to be discrepancies because that's just they're different people and they process it differently. And the theory is they're always going to try to present themselves usually in the best light. So usually their version is going to be a little more rosy about them than others. And if they're not presenting themselves in a rosy thing, you're even more likely to believe it. And you have these fraudsters, which are always spinning. And already Todd, it's so thing. So yes, is it true? Is it not true? Are we ever going to know? No.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue into this whole discussion about art and what is good art, because the story revolves around the art forger, like we mentioned, and that he claims, and again, this is his claiming, that there are multiple museums throughout the world that have his forgery in their museums. And so let's say he did a Picasso drawing and, you know, whatever Guggenheim Museum bought it and it displays it. We have the greatest collection of Picasso's works. He's like, well, one of those is a forgery. So doesn't that, if that is convinced, if you're convinced that that is a Picasso, then how do we know that those other ones aren't? It just opens so many doors into art and critique. And the sad part was that the Elmer, that's his name, the forger.
Yeah, I think it's Elmer.
He spent all his life trying to make a living as an artist and couldn't make it. And so he found his best fame and found a living by making fake forgery. I mean, just making forgery. So he'll do a Picasso or I'm blanking on the other, Rembrandt, whatever. And that's how he made his living, by making fake art. And it's like, well, but he's also making his own art and he can't make a living through that. Isn't there a disconnect here in the art world and critique? That part is very, very interesting.
What I also thought was interesting is you have experts that'll say, well, this is obviously real, you know, like depending on how you present it to people, this is true. Oh, if you say to them, isn't this a fake? Oh yes, you can tell by this and this. So it's like, it just shows you the experts on such a subjective field are basically just making stuff up at a whole cloth. Mm-hmm. And then you have dealers that know that they're selling something that's probably, like, they have a dealer there. He's like, well, I started to wonder if it was a fraud, but I didn't want to dig too deep because I really didn't want to know. It's like, they didn't want to know how the hot dog was made. You know, it's just like, what's in the dog? Who knows? Is this really done by this artist? I don't know, but I know I can sell it for a profit. So I'm buying it from this forger for a pittance compared to what they're selling it for. So they're making money and people are putting it on their wall. But then is that art any less art, or is it, that's what goes into the subjective thing, in which, because whose name is attached to it. And there's a great quote that I want to read from Orson Welles that goes into that whole aspect.
And go ahead.
And I'm not going to do this anywhere near as good as Orson Welles' voice, but if you want to hear it from Orson, watch the movie, because, I mean, I could splice it in there, but I want to force you people to watch the movie to get it from the master. Our works in stone, in paint, in print, are spared, some of them for a few decades or a millennium or two. But everything must finally fall in war or wear away into the ultimate and universal ash. The triumphs, the frauds, the treasures, and the fakes. A fact of life, we're going to die. Be of good heart, cried a dead artist out of the living past. Our songs will all be silenced, but what of it? Go on singing. Maybe a man's name doesn't matter all that much.
Well said, well said.
Oh, thank you. But I think that's the whole point of this, is does it really matter? I mean, the artwork is there. If it's virtually the same, then is it different?
Yeah. It brings up a whole bunch of questions on, again, the expert. I can tell a fake Picasso. There's a story in there that the artist, they brought a whole bunch of original, if it's Picasso, they brought to Picasso a whole bunch of his work, and then they put in some forgeries throughout. And he's pointing to the forgery. I didn't do that. And then he pointed to a painting that he did do. And he goes, I didn't do that. And they said, well, you know, I saw you paint that. And he goes, yes, but sometimes I paint fake Picassos. And it's like, wait, what? I butchered, you know, what he said, but it's along those lines of, it's like, if he can't tell what he painted, then how can, it's frustrating and wonderful to wrap your mind around that.
Yeah, and there's also sometimes people will do work and they won't want to claim it anymore. You know, where is
yeah,
it?
The, yeah.
For directors, what name did he use? Walter Smith.
Oh, Alan Smithy.
Yeah, Alan Smithy.
Yeah, yeah.
If they don't want to claim their work, they're like, oh, it's Alan Smithy. It's Alan Smithy did it.
And
that kind of thing. And they don't want to claim it. So I can see an artist, especially one as Picasso, who did so much work, there could be works out there that he would be like, I really didn't care for that. Well, I'm just gonna, that's a fake Picasso. And I do the best fake Picassos because I know Picasso.
Yeah, fascinating. Just again, the thoughts on experts, and it's like, well, who gave you the power to say that this is true or forgery, or like, who says that you can, art critics, this is art? And it's like, yeah, well, you think this guy who's just living on the side of the road, he painted a Picasso, and you think, oh, this is a Picasso. Well, why is his work less valuable than an actual painting? It's a frustrating talk. It goes into movies. I mean, it goes into everything. It's like, why are some movies winning Academy Awards and why are some other movies not? Why is this movie critically acclaimed? This is the best movie of the year. And I'll watch it and be like, this is the worst piece of junk. Why do movies that are considered trash, why do I get enjoyment out of some of those? I'm sure you can attest to this. This is one of the top 10 worst movies ever made. And I'm like, I don't know. I had a lot of fun watching this compared to the movie that won Best Original Screenplay at the Oscars a few years ago. It's who gets to say what is art?
Well, this is going to gear me up. What I'm going to say is going to gear up the quote I have asked you to read. And it was pretty much, everything is subjective. We all look at it and we all analyze this material, and people will have different opinions, which is great, which is why I love doing movie discussions with other people. And you and I happen to agree on a lot of these films because we both have views in, but there's points we disagree with. And there's things that we've discussed, you know, that weren't recorded where we have a movie coming up, ladies and gentlemen, that, when we talk about Independence Day for 4th of July, which hopefully we'll have recorded and have out this year, where Josh and I guarantee you are not going to be coming off on the same track, you know, that there's going to be differences there, but I appreciate the movie still, and movies that don't work for me, I can understand, because if somebody went through and made it, you had a whole team. So it's not just one person. It's one person's vision or a couple people's vision, but it still got done. And there are things that, yes, I've seen and I think are just utter garbage. And I don't even want to spend time talking about them because they were just so bad. But I'll talk to somebody else and they love that puppy, you know. And I'm just it's eye to beholder type stuff. And this quote, which I asked Josh if he could read, you know, from the movie, I think is just so appropriate for what we're talking about right now.
All right. With your permission, a bit of verse by Kipling. When first the flush of a newborn sun fell on the green and gold, our father Adam sat under the tree and scratched with a stick in the mold. And the first rude sketch that the world had seen was joy to his mighty heart, till the devil whispered behind the leaves, "It's pretty. But is it art?"
Excellent job, sir. And I love the line.
Thank you.
I love the line because it fits so well. Till the devil whispered, "It's pretty, but is it art?" There's so many times I've had talks with people and I said, "I really like this movie." And they're like, and they'll automatically start trashing it. Well, it's not that great. It's like, well, it's good. You don't have to trash my opinion of it. I can understand you're coming from. You know, and we see this online all the time. But this has been going on for decades and decades and decades.
Yeah, yeah.
Or centuries or millenniums, if you look at art overall. But just speaking of movies, where somebody will say, this movie's trash. Like, because you'll put a thing on, like every so often, you know, people, this movie was terrible. Well, why was it terrible? Why was it trash? Elaborate, you know, give me an understanding so I know where you're basing your opinion off of. But it's people just be like, it's not art. It's just that it doesn't have to be art to be entertaining. You know, and then people say, well, it wasn't art, but it was entertaining. Okay.
It's like, well, then, yeah. Well, is art not supposed to be entertaining? It's so many questions arise from that. Yeah.
Which are almost, which we could do a podcast on one time. I might do that where we get a round table with some, like another director besides yourself and maybe another film enthusiast or two. And we can just talk about this subject matter, and we're never going to get to an agreement, but it would be fascinating to go into.
Interesting conversation. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that sounds wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. Cause again, the question of, I think now we're getting into real philosophical territory. Like the worst sin a movie can commit is be boring. And I've seen some dull movies that are critically acclaimed and, oh, this is such a, it's like, this was so dull. And then I'll watch, you know, Prehistoric Women with, you know, Mrs. Kennedy, widely regarded as one of the worst films ever made. I was like, I get so much joy out of watching this film. How can this wonderful feeling that I'm feeling be considered trash when I feel absolute abysmal boredom watching something else? But that's art. It's so shouldn't art make me feel happy? It's again, I keep saying that this whole podcast, there's so many things. Watch F for Fake, ladies and gentlemen. It's so thought provoking and glorious.
And just so listeners that don't know, when he refers to Mrs. Kennedy, he's referring to Martine Beswick, because they're very close. They're very good friends. And the ongoing joke is that they're husband and wife. They're not, but just so people wonder, like, there's no Mrs. Kennedy in Prehistoric Women. It's an inside joke about Martine Beswick, and the two of them are just inseparable when they're in the same areas together. And I know that'll be happening hopefully soon at Monster Bash this early November, yes. 2024, where Martine Beswick, Carolyn Monroe, Valerie Leone and Victoria Vetri, mm-hmm. are all going to be there, the Hammer ladies, you know, and stuff like that. I've met three of the four. I have not met Valerie Leone, so this will be my first time meeting her, so I'm looking forward to that. But to re-meet Caroline and Martine, who are so nice enough to do interviews with me, and then they're so nice people. If you can be there and somehow get them away from Joshua so you can spend time with them, that Joshua's nice enough. He won't bother them. He won't keep, you know, take all their time from you, but they're all very close. The Caroline and Martine are very close with Josh. They've done movies with him. House of the Gorgon in particular would be a highlight. And just since we're talking about art, I know there are people that are listening to this that have seen House of the Gorgon and they don't understand what it is and what it's about, or they don't like it because it's not a big production. And some people don't realize that Martine is retired, basically. She only does work for you. And this also had Veronica Carlson, who was retired, but at the time was only doing work for you. And why they did it was, one, they liked you because you're like family. And they got to do it with each other, and they had fun. And the House of the Gorgon, also with the wonderful Christopher Neim, is people have to understand, yes, it was a low-budget movie. Yes, the acting could be uneven with the co-stars that are in it, not with the main cast. I enjoyed it so much because I know the behind the stories, too, is that everybody did it because they wanted to do the film, to have fun, to be together. And you can see that they are having fun. They are enjoying themselves. And how often do you get that? So instead of being a negative and looking at it, it's like, oh, why did they do this? You should be happy that they did this because you get to see them, which, sadly for Veronica Carlson, was the one last time. And she does an awesome job stealing the movie with these comedic lines and her spot-on delivery. And that's the things you have to realize is that, yes, think back to Lon Chaney Jr. with some of the N-work, or Boris Karloff with some of those N-work. Yeah, the movies were great, but they still were there. You still got to see them perform, and they loved to do it. They loved to do the work. Now, some of them were doing it because they had to for the money back then. Other of them just didn't need the money. Vincent Price didn't. He just did it because he loved to do it. And some of these parts. If you just look at their parts, you just enjoy it, and it brings that nostalgia, that sentimentality, that just enjoyment. You get to see that you're one of your favorite stars one last time or one more time. And I want to thank you for saying that, but I think this fits in perfectly for what is art or not art. Is this a movie? Is it? I'm entertained. Is it high class? The budget was bare bones. And if you take all that into account, you can understand where the movie's coming from. But just enjoy this 1 week filmed movie, you know, done on a shoestring budget, but done with love and joy and happiness, and just treasure those moments, because you never know when those moments will be gone.
Well, thank you. That was very, very sweet. Exactly what I needed to hear today. Thank you. That was very nice. It was for them. It was a movie made for them, and it was their idea. Everyone's like, where did you get this idea? I was like, it was Caroline Monroe's idea. It's like, let's all make a movie. But being able to separate, I think there's people that go in. I mean, everyone watches movies differently, and people expecting, you know, a big budget Marvel movie, and then they see, you know, oh wait, this movie was shot in 5 days, and this isn't what I expected it to be, and they lash out or they'll write mean stuff online, and it's like, well, I think they're welcome to that opinion. I mean, everyone's welcome to their opinion on what constitutes a good movie, what constitutes art, and then there's other people like you, Steve, that very, very kind of you to say that it's like you can separate. You almost watch it in a different fashion than just turning your brain off and like, okay, entertain me. It's like, oh wait, no, there's much more behind this. Just like F for Fake, there's more. You peel the curtain behind. It's like, oh wait, they had no money, but they just wanted to make this. Oh, fun. Okay, now let's. As I think, it's a whole much more. It's a much different way of watching movies, and some movies can like Dark Shadows. I know you're big on Dark Shadows too. Watching that, and they had a shoestring budget, and you know that there's a guy with a fishing pole with the bat, and there's, you know, you see the boom mic and stuff, but that just adds so much enjoyment for me, and I suppose for you too, and for fans of the show, where it's like, okay, no. They're a group of actors and crew members trying to put on a show, and that is so enjoyable to watch because you want them to succeed, and they're sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Sometimes there are effects in Dark Shadows where you're like, hey, that's really cool. Well done, guys. And then other ones where you're like, all right. But there's an enjoyment to that, and I consider that. I mean, would I consider it art? I get a kick out of it. I get more of a kick out of watching, you know, boom mics and Dark Shadows than I do looking at Da Vinci's, you know, Mona Lisa or something. When it comes to my stuff, I hope that audiences, you know, but I hope they have fun with it. And I don't want to call it art, but maybe they don't take it so seriously. This clearly isn't, you know, art. Maybe it's art to some people, but yeah, thank you for that. That was very, very sweet. I would hope audiences feel the same way.
Oh, I do. And taking us back to F for Fake and tying it together, it's like we said, art is, what is art? That the devil says it was entertaining, but was it art? So, and some people say the devil is in the details. I mean, there's so many things.
Yeah, that you can
look at it with this religious part. So with Orson, he's making a statement here about all of his work prior and all of his work that was to come. And this was really one of his final films that he directed and had full control of the process. I know there was a film released after, you know, after he passed away, but he, you know, and he tried to do as much, but it wasn't him. Mm-hmm. And to me, this was his last masterpiece, you know, that I can use the word for me. Out of his work, this was like the final one. You know, this would be the capstone of his directorial career. And then he, you know, went on other. He did some other things, but there were shorts or there were other video essays, whatever way you want to look at it. And it's, you wonder if he would have had the money and the stuff to do it, what would have happened? What would have turned up? What other things would have been around the corner? Because he was so much of a trickster And speaking about how he always loved magic, I think if I remember correctly, his last interview was, I believe, on the Merv Griffin show. And he had a cane, and he lost significant weight, is having health issues, and he performed magic.
Oh, really?
On the stage of the Merv Griffin show to the audience. He was doing tricks. He loved to perform. He loved to entertain. And if you have that meta knowledge and knowing, and you can find it on YouTube, Orson Welles, Merv Griffin. I think they labeled it as his last, interview or last appearance. I remember seeing it a couple of years ago, and just you're watching it, and you watch it with bittersweetness, knowing that this is your last time that he was going to do something. And I think he was there to promote his biography. You know, somebody had wrote a book.
Oh, okay.
I think that was what he was there to promote, but he was also doing these tricks and the stories. And as we've both said, are the stories real or not real? Didn't these really happen? Are these embellishments? Who knows? But it's like when you had your uncle telling you stories or your aunt telling you stories and he added them all, because the good storytellers know where to add the extra flavor.
Oh, yes.
And sometimes that flavor is true, and sometimes it's a little artificial. So is it real sugar, or was it artificial sweetener? Who knows?
I was never afraid to stretch things a bit, but yeah.
And that's the same thing with filmmakers. And this film, F for Fake, there are parts that are stretched. We're not going to spoil what part, did it go and switch from true to fake. We've already mentioned it in this, because we've been 100% true during this whole podcast.
We should have started off with that. For the next 45 minutes, we will say everything true.
But did I know what everything that Joshua said is 100% true? We believe it is all true. But are we true?
We would like to think. We would like to think it's true.
Or was there any fraud in this? We're never going to tell. You're never going to know. But I know this. F for Fake is available to watch on Max. You could rent it. I'm sure it's rental availability. You can get the Criterion version. Of course, we know they do their 50% off sales, where it's either Barnes & Noble or Criterion. They come up twice a year. I recommend you own it on physical media. I have it on my list for my birthday Christmas list so hopefully somebody in my family will get it for me. Because I just enjoy it. I want to hear the commentary version. I want to see the behind the scenes stuff they have there, which, Criterion is known to have. I don't know what parts they're there, but I want to, it's one of those things that you can enjoy it, and you can spot these little flows, these ebbs, these nooks, these crannies, because I really think that in the whole movie, nobody's telling me the truth, but
it's so enjoyable. So enjoyable. I didn't mean to interrupt. It's just, I watched it last night. I'm ready to watch it again. That is so rare for a movie to, it's like, I'm ready to, because I know there's going to be something I catch this time or see something in a different light. I highly recommend it as well. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Please. No, I'm agreeing with you, and there's no interruption because we're both doing this together. It's a duet.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a duet. And also, if I'm to be honest with my critique with it, there are some parts where it does stall for me, and it's only on the parts really where it's Oya. It's the parts where they're constantly showing her in the Picasso part, walking back and forth, or they're going back. It goes a little long in a couple spots there for me, where I was watching, I was just like, I got the point, Orson. I got the point.
We get it. You can,
it's like, let's move. But as we already said, she was his muse. So for the director to cut parts of her walking in various forms of attire and things like that, I can see, I understand why it was not cut, because actually imagine how much he probably did cut. And that was the parts that were left. I mean,
exactly. Yeah. That's the cut we ended up with. Can you imagine the director's cut? Yeah.
What was left on the cutting room floor. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I didn't have a problem with it. I was more fascinated with the the editing techniques. I'm like, oh, cool. And just how they I don't want to give anything away, but they fashion some shots. I'm like, oh, wait, that's fabricated.
One thing we did highlight earlier, but we said we were going to get to later, and I almost forgot. So thankfully, as we're nearing the end, at least I remembered it so people don't go, well, you guys didn't talk about this. There was a part I said where the two guys were never together during the sequence,
yes.
And the way they shot it was when you had Clifford Irving and Almir. And I'm just, that's the way they refer to him. They always refer to him by his first name. I mean, it's
yeah, yeah.
And he is such a character. He is such a joy that I am glad to see him encapsulated on film. And that's somebody I wish I had a chance to, you know, talk about people meeting. Like, this would be somebody you'd want to have dinner with also.
Oh,
just
yes,
because
yes.
I'm sure he was such a showman, such a, the way he was presenting himself. He was, and he had such an interesting life with tragedy and other things. I mean, they refer to him being imprisoned. They don't really refer to what he was imprisoned for, but at that time and at that place, he was imprisoned because of his homosexuality. For a couple of months, and it's amazing, you know, things happen, and you still have certain countries where people get killed or thrown out still to this day. So it's interesting how some things have changed at a high point, and other things have not changed at all in different societies. But I don't want to go on. I just want to mention that briefly. But the two of them, there's a thing where it looks like they're having this meaningful interplay and the way it's edited, but because their facial expressions, there's no dialogue if I remember right, but it's just the way they're looking. And sometimes there's parts where Clifford, it's just a still shot and they refer back to him and you see the still of Clifford, but they pause on it long enough to make it so it has that effect of what the image is. And it's, you can just see, yes, that's why you can't call it a documentary, because it's a docudrama, or as you said, even better, a video essay, as other people have, because, and I've said this with a lot of documentaries, most of the ones I've seen, the vast majority, are not 100% true. The documentarian is leading you on a path, and they're going to pick certain shots or select certain things. So a lot of them are the very best documentarians in my ones are honest, and they will try to show both sides of an issue, both things, and be fair.
Yeah.
And then you have the ones that they have a certain idea they want and they take it that way. And then you have other ones that go with the story that they filmed. Hoop Dreams is a great example where they filmed, they got the story, and then they went and honestly tried to portray the story of what they filmed to the best of their ability. But having said that, they're still going to be things that are shot, storylines that are set up to drive us as the audience, because they also, at the end, they want to entertain us. They want to make money, or they want to get a certain cause across. And so this one is no different than any other in that aspect, but it's fascinating to learn about those two lies. Lies or lives?
Or both.
Yeah, I can't really say I screwed up there or not, because...
I know, right? That was kind of... it kind of worked.
It kind of works because of what they are or who they were. And I am so happy that Orson Welles was able to take this work that was done by other people and then film extra stuff and craft it into this. But what did you think about the editing, just setting up this interplay that never happened?
And I mean, movie buffs will be hyper aware, and then me too, being an editor, you're hyper aware of tricks that sometimes you use if you're shooting an interview and maybe you need to, there's an important moment, maybe the interviewee starts crying or something, and you want to let that moment breathe. Sometimes you'll cut away to, you know, a picture of, you know, their dead dog, and you'll cut back to them, and you'll just use footage of them. Just maybe they're just, you're setting up lights and you just have the camera running, and it's just footage of them being silent, but you put it into the film or the video that you're cutting just to let the scene breathe. And so they say, oh, you know, my dog died, cut to the picture of the dog and cut back. And they're just like looking off into the distance. And perhaps them being filmed, they're just thinking about what they're going to do after them being filmed. But you cut it together in such a way that it's like, wow, this is very moving. They're thinking about their dog. And that's what editing does. There's the famous, I'm sure you've heard of this, the Kuleshov experiment. Way back in Russia when films were just starting, they took a whole bunch of audience members, sat them down in a room, and showed them footage of a man staring at the camera. And then they cut to a picture of a bowl of soup. And then they cut back to the man. And then they come out and they ask the audience, they're like, okay, so what was the man thinking? And they're like, well, you know, the man was hungry. You know, he was thinking about the soup. He was a hungry man. It's like, okay, interesting. And then they bring back the audience again, and they show footage of a man looking into the camera, and then a footage of a little coffin, and it cuts back to the man. And the audience says, the man was, he was sad because he lost his child. He was like on the verge of tears. And then they do it again. They did it multiple times. And it's like, well, the man was happy because he thought of, you know, his son. The man was, you know, sexually aroused because it was a sexy woman. And we find out that it was the exact same shot of a man that was filmed. And the director told the man, just look into the camera, don't think anything. But it was associating the two images of the man looking into the camera with the bowl of soup or the coffin that the audience automatically starts putting things into their heads. It's like, okay, this is what this is. And so there's a scene in Epiphake that we were just talking about where it's two completely different interviews that somehow Orson found a way to cut together to make it seem like they're talking to one another. it's wonderful, and it matches up really, really well. And then they I think the question that one of them asks the other inadvertently, it says, did you ever sign the picture, the paintings, the forgeries that you painted, did you ever sign them? And then Orson cuts to a whole bunch of just pauses in the interviews, and it makes it seem like there's like this tension in the air. And it's again a masterclass in editing, because they were probably shot months apart from each other, didn't even know, and you just cut them together in such a way that they have this wonderful two forgerers, well, and then two forgerers talking about one another, and then you have Orson as the ultimate forgery as well, cutting it together. Oh, it's a wonderful combination of forgery and editing, and it's an experience. You have to see it to fully experience it. And I wonder if people who you know aren't aware of editing, I that'd be difficult to find, or of those techniques, that they actually think that they're in the same room together. I that would be interesting to. You know, like, do they actually believe that they were being interviewed together? That would be an interesting question.
It would be, because you'd think, oh, they said two different cameras, so they were together, and you never know.
Yeah, yeah.
And what I love about this is all taking place during the 60 minutes, which is supposed to be everything is true. Now,
yeah,
but
yeah.
It sets up a false thing, and it's a false, but it's like when people say, well, they took the you took what I said out of context.
Out of context,
what they
yeah.
said is true. That part that they said, that clip that they said is true. But you put it together with all these other clips that are true, you make a different context out of
mm-hmm.
it. And I find, so in Morrison's mind, when he made that statement, this is 60 minutes, we're never going to lie. That is true, but the way they set it up gives you an impression that was never what was intended with what was originally filmed. So is that true? Or is that the lie? Well, is that the...
And they all said, he didn't put words in their mouth, that everything they said is exactly what they said. Maybe it was just cut in a different fashion, but that's what they said. It was true. Yeah.
Yeah. It was all true, or was it not? I love it. I just love it, because you can go crazy with it and really think about it. And I want, as Josh and I said, we both highly recommend, Josh said several times, just stop the podcast, go watch the movie. And
yes.
So obviously either you've done that, so now you know exactly what we're referring to, or you're going to do that after this. But F for Fake is one of Orson Welles' best films that I, you know, and I know we've done two of his films, and we haven't even, it'll be a while before we probably ever get to what everybody considers his masterpiece. I don't know when we're going to do it, when it'll eventually hit when we do Citizen Kane. But you know, yeah. we're going to eventually hit. Josh will be picking the next Orson film. But I will tell you, the next Charlton Heston film that we'll be doing with Mark Maddox, who joined us for The Omega Man, is going to be Soylent Green. Yes, we're sticking in the 70s, and we're going to go Soylent Green. And that's what I'm picking. And I believe Mark is picking The Naked Jungle, right?
Yeah, for
the one after that. So those will be the two Charlton Heston things. Then we'll come back to Josh picking Charlton Heston. But Josh will be picking the next Orson Welles film, and I'm not sure if he knows what he's going to pick now or if he's just going to let you guys find out when it comes. Charlton Heston.
Yeah, let's announce it in the next one. Let me think on that.
We'll announce it. When you listen to Soylent Green, you'll know where the next Orson Welles film is coming.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm just enjoying it. And I want to remind listeners that Josh has a movie that's up for the Rondo Awards. Josh, tell them about it and tell them how to vote.
That's right. Thank you. The Innsmouth School for Girls is my latest film that's out. H.P. Lovecraft fans will find something to love about it, I'm sure. Very proud of that's one of the films I'm really, really proud of. Labor of Love, as they all are, but I think that one's particularly successful. If you go to, I think it's rondoaward.com, and then you can see the gigantic ballot that the wonderful David Colton has. He does, you know, the Lord's work in getting some of these films that would have never seen the light of day or find an audience. He helps. And also aspects, film, magazines, interviews, DVD commentaries. He's really giving a voice to some voices that should be heard. And if you're interested in voting, check it out, rondoaward.com. And the Innsmouth School for Girls is on Amazon Prime if you have any interest in checking that one out. And it's on DVD at oldies.com as well. Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Steve.
Well, you're welcome. If, like I said, you could check it out, like you said, on streaming. And if you like it, buy it on Oldies, because that'll help independent filmmakers continue making independent films, because they get a little more cha-ching from the physical purchase than they do from the pittance that they get from the streaming.
When I say pittance, I mean pittance.
I've talked to many independent filmmakers, and it's not much of anything. So, And while you're at it, just remember, if you also want to, you can vote for this podcast. It's been nominated for the Rondos.
Same
ballot. You can send it on the same email. We've been nominated for a few years in a row now. I have no expectations of winning, but I am happy that people recognize the podcast, because we cover all genres, and I know it's a horror-specific award, but it's just an honor to be nominated, and there are so many worthy podcasts that are out there that also... I could go on forever to say that they also deserve to win. So it's, if you vote for us, I'm honored. I'm just honored to be nominated. And with on the same ballots that Innsmouth School for Girls is on and other things, it's just an honor to be on there with those same people in that same thing. So it's great. Josh, thank you for joining me again. And I'm looking forward to your movies that are coming out. I know you filmed a bunch. And then there'll be more coming out as we discuss stuff. But listeners, help independent filmmakers get their stuff. Help them make their projects come true, especially if you enjoy their movies. It's like giving them a tip. Buy the Blu-ray. You're giving them a tip, and you get a movie, a physical copy in return. It's a tip, and you get the gift. I mean,
win-win.
It's a win-win. And definitely see F for Fake.
Amen.
Hello, everybody. I hope everybody enjoyed the movie discussion that Joshua Kennedy and I did. I really enjoyed it. Anytime we get to talk about Orson Welles, it's always a fun time. Just want to remind everybody that if you wanted to vote in the Rondo Awards, like you heard Joshua and I talking about, you still have time, so please feel free to do so. You can vote for the Diecast Movie Podcast. You can also vote for Innsmouth School for Girls and many other things that are on the ballot. So please take your time to go for it, and I hope everybody is having a good day. If you want to send us an email, send it to us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com, or you can leave us a message on our Facebook page, which is also Diecast Movie Podcast. feel free to follow and like it, and that way you'll know when new episodes are coming out. And also you can follow us or like us, whatever, on your podcast host. You can subscribe to it. It's free, and that way when every time a new episode comes out, you'll get it automatically. To end the episode, I thought it was a fitting thing to go out with the finale of F for Fake, so you get to hear Orson Welles talking. You get to hear Orson Welles end the film, and I thought the words he said would fit for us. So I want to thank everybody for listening again, and I hope everybody has a good night. Let's go into the end of F for Fake.
Time for a confession.
Time to go.
Good night, Arya. That's a real name, you know. Arya. Arya Koda. I don't think that young gentleman's a trombone player, but Arya's grandfather was Hungarian, did he? Paint any pictures?
Never in his life.
Ladies and gentlemen, we did use Oya's grandfather to lend verisimilitude to the reenactment of this story. But is reenactment really the word? What I mean is, with a story this hard to believe, reenactment isn't easy. Right, Francois? At the very beginning of all this, I did make you a promise. Remember? I did promise that for 1 hour, I'd tell you only the truth. That hour, ladies and gentlemen, is over. For the past 17 minutes, I've been lying my head off. The truth, and please forgive us for it, is that we've been forging an art story. As a charlatan, of course, my job was to try to make it real. Not that reality has anything to do with it. Reality? It's the toothbrush waiting at home for you in its glass. A bus ticket, a paycheck, and the grave. In the right mood, perhaps Elmire has just as few regrets as I have to have been a charlatan. But we're not so proud, either of us, as to lay any superior claim to being very much worse than the rest of you. No, what we professional liars hope to serve is truth. I'm afraid the pompous word for that is art. Picasso himself said it. Art, he said, is a lie. A lie that makes us realize the truth. Oya's grandfather, floating here in the air, has no comment, which isn't surprising because he never existed. To the memory of that great man who will never cease to exist, I offer my apologies. And wish you all, true and false, a very pleasant good evening.